Hello, and welcome to All Sacred Ground on the Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And to those of you who are in the chat room joining us live, thank you so much for tuning in. This is our 21st episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at around 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, on this July 11th, 2015. And I apologize for some technical issues that led to today's show being a little bit later than we had originally hoped, but that is absolutely no matter when it comes to our excellent, excellent guest, because today is I'm joined by guest David Shi, who is an animist worker and folk magician who is operating in the North, primarily in the North Asian magical traditions. And David has been a longtime friend of mine. I'm so glad that he's here to share his knowledge of the topic with us. And we'll be having him in just a second. And today is a call-in show, so if you have any questions, comments, or would like to share some of your stories, thoughts, questions, comments, concerns with myself or our guest, please call in at 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And make sure that you press 1 so that I know that you're in the queue. As we do every week, we'll be beginning today's show with a poem from Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 prayers, poems, and invocations for honoring the earth. And this poem slash prayer comes to us from India. White floating clouds like the plains, come and water the earth. Sun, embrace the earth, that she may be fruitful. Moon, lion of the north, bear of the west, badger of the south, wolf of the east, eagle of the heavens, shrew of the earth, elder war hero, intercede with the cloud people for us, that they may water the earth. But before I introduce David more fully, I have to speak to what this poem really just engenders in me. I actually just got back from a retreat in Arizona. I got back this morning that was focused on shamanic ritual and tradition. And it's really amazing today that we get to speak with someone with such a knowledge of the peoples from which that word that we use so much in the West, without fully understanding it, shaman and shamanism. We're truly privileged to have someone who understands the culture from which this word was sort of taken and then applied to cultures around the world. Shamanism is a word that I think for a lot of us in the West, it is sort of the best we have to work with when it comes to some of the work that we're doing or some of the beliefs that we hold or some of the worldview that we're trying to maintain. And so having a guest who can speak so fully to the origin of this word and the people who held this origin of the word is amazing. But having this poem is just sort of reminding me of my own past week and the importance of remembering that even though we must listen to indigenous voices, we must, if we're truly going to understand what needs to be done in this world. And we must hear out indigenous voices in terms of filling in the gaps in our traditions, I believe, really, and in our lives in the West. The elements belong to all of us. And the sacred directions belong, animal spirits belong to all of us. And there's a a really heady conversation about the word appropriation that goes around. And I believe that there's a lot to be said about the word appropriation, about appropriative tactics when it comes to spirituality and spiritual traditions. But, and again, that conversation needs to be had, but it must not occlude the fact that the sacred directions, the elements, the engagement with animal spirits, ritual, ceremony, these technologies, these kin, belong to all of us as biological human beings. No matter how long it has been since our own ancestors have connected with these traditions, etc. As a being, having been born here on Earth, maybe not the symbols, maybe not the ways in which things have been done, but ritual itself, the elements, the directions, these sacred ways of being and ways of interacting belong to all of us. Without further ado, David is an animistic worker and folk magician of Manchurian descent. Raised in a household that incorporated both Siberian and North Chinese practices, David has dedicated his spare time to the study of the spiritual traditions of his ancestors and Greater Eurasia. Through hours of meditation, journeys, and rituals, David has developed special relationships with both spirits and respected members of the New York pagan, magical, and spiritual communities. He has also studied witchcraft, rootwork and conjure, and room lore, and is a reader of tarot, runes, and bones. David also teaches the Korean traditional drumming art. And you can contact him if you have any questions after the show at davidshi311@gmail.com. And without further ado, we are being joined by David, I hope. David, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I absolutely can. Thank you so much for joining me here.
Glad to be here.
So I'd love to start with, you know, because you give it a quick background about the household you were raised in that incorporated both Siberian and North Chinese practices. How would you define yourself? How would you identify in terms of North Asian cultures and how you were raised, if you don't mind sort of extrapolating on that?
Sure. So basically my family is, again, from a region called Manchuria. Now, for those of you who don't know, Manchuria is a region that currently half of which belongs to northeast China. The other half belongs to southeast Russia. My parents very much came from the side that's on the Chinese side of the border. And growing up, even though that area has experienced heavy waves of communism, a lot of the folk traditions still maintain. Growing up, a lot of these things that we did every day were not necessarily explained to me, but through growing up and throughout asking questions much later in life, I was able to get to the root of all of these practices that we did culturally and spiritually, what specifically applied to our Manchurian heritage, what came from Chinese practices, and what might have come from Siberian-based practices. Because growing up, a lot of it was kind of meshed together. And because there was some kind of, not necessarily discrimination, but almost like an emphasis on the Chinese-ish of the side, the umbrella term Chinese has been put over all of this, which I actually began to notice had very, very different meanings and angles from what a lot of other Chinese people were practicing. So that's when I discovered that a lot of what I had practiced did, in fact, come from non-Chinese regions. So that's basically the general source of it. My family was very much atheist, as they were raised in very communist backgrounds, but we did maintain sort of a cultural hold to the spiritual practices, even if my parents and grandparents professed that they did not believe in any of the spiritual or magical practices. These were some of the things that we just did quote unquote just in case. So.
Just in case. Can you explain sort of what? I mean, I know that's a heavy thing to ask, but could you sort of give us an idea of what a just in case familial household practice might look like?
Sure. So, for example, one practice, very simple practice that we did to ensure that we were able to survive financially, have enough food over the winter, was actually hanging dry corn outside our door and outside under the sheets of our roof. And basically, if I asked my parents what those were for, they would basically say that, oh, that's, you know, just so that we can survive through winter. We have enough food for the winter. And then me being a curious little kid asking them, do you actually believe in it? Of course, they would say, no, we don't, but just in case. So that was sort of practice, was one of the practices that we had going along with similar Chinese practices, such as hanging the character for prosperity upside down, which also brings in prosperity, which we did just in case. And some of the other things, such as how we celebrate the holidays, the actions that we did to, you know, to bring in good luck for the year, or to make sure that we have protection or that we have success, everything was done just in case. But if you ask anyone in my family if they believed it, they would have said no. But they did it just in case.
So I think one thing that people would love to know is how do you classify the idea of, especially within the cultures that that we're talking about today and your own household experience, how would you classify the word shamanism versus the word magic?
So shamanism, based on the traditions, especially of Southeast Asia, especially from the Evenki and the Manchurian, the Tungus origins of the word shaman, really involves more, one, the basic idea is working with the spirits. It's connecting with the spirits in the sense that other people cannot, because the shaman is one who is chosen by the spirits to act as their form on earth. So frequently shamans would joke that they essentially don't really have much sovereignty over their bodies compared to that of other people, because the shaman was chosen for that purpose. But then a shaman also has an utmost responsibility. Their responsibility is to the community, and it is to maintain balance within themselves, within their families, and within their communities. Now, this is not necessarily the same as magic, because magic is something that you don't necessarily have to be chosen by the spirits to do, although chances are people who do practice magic are ones who have gifts regardless. But magic, in terms of those traditions, were conducted by people to either improve aspects of their life, to deal with negative aspects of their life, to deal with sickness. But it is something that is common for the folk, for common folk to do, whereas the word shaman is essentially a doctor for the spirit who is chosen for this particular path, most of the time whether or not they want it or not. And the shaman becomes the spiritual and in some cases the cultural authority within the community.
So the way we're talking about the difference between practices and specialists in the practice.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
So in a way we're talking about the difference between sort of like specialists and we're talking about the difference between practices and specialists in the practice.
Yes
plus
and
the
no.
Addition of, oh, okay, please, yeah, continue.
So a lot of the practices, yes, are done by shamans as well, but the specific duties that the shaman and perform are not necessarily something that everyone else can perform. So while we can say that they are specialists in matters of the spirit and working with the spirits of the land, of nature, of the ancestors, they are more of the bridge. They serve as the bridge for the community to access the spirits. It's said that the reason shamans exist is that they connect their communities to the realms of the spirits. So without the shaman in the community essentially, they can still practice magic, but they would be cut off from communication and cut off to guidance from their ancestors and from the spirits that are around them.
Interesting. Okay. So on one hand, there's also the element of magic being more sort of practice and lore driven, while the shamanic practices are more spirit driven.
Yes. One thing that I will say though is in the regions north of the Great Wall, so this would include Manchuria, Mongolia, Siberia, and to some extent the old Korean practices, a lot of their magic was also tied to the spirits. And even in China, where shamanic practices have declined in the past couple of thousand years, the common folk in their practice of magic would still make petitions of spirits. They will ask the spirit. They will plead to the spirits for guidance, but it is not the same kind of direct communication that a shaman would have. It is based, they would still pray to the spirits that they know, but it is not through specifically shamanic practices of going into trance, into ritual trance, to commune directly or to journey directly to the homes of the spirits.
I'm curious as to what point, growing up in a household that was doing sort of just-in-case folk magic practices, became for you, at what point did a shift happen for you that made you say, I need to engage more deeply or I need to study this more deeply?
A lot of it was a combination of various factors. Actually, to some extent, it was things that were going on in my life that kept pointing me in the direction of signs from every day, and also through dreams as well. It's not uncommon, especially within the cosmology of these spiritualities, that spirits or spiritual entities will come to you in dreams and then advise you or just give you guidance on what you need to do. And for me, they came almost simultaneously, these spiritual entities of ancestors that I had no idea where they had come from, as well as just things in my life that seem to be going pretty stagnant. They encouraged me to explore the spiritual and magical practices of my ancestors, and the first step for me of that was to find out exactly who my ancestors were. Now, historically, in the recent history, a lot of our knowledge of our ancestors has actually been destroyed because of purges by communism. A lot of our records, a lot of our family records were destroyed, and I actually did not know who my ancestors were past my great-great-grandparents or where they had come from. The assumption is that some of them came from China, some of them came from Southeast Siberia, but essentially which tribes they came from, which regions, did they migrate from anywhere, that much was lost. So for me, the first step was to find out who these people were, where they had come from, what did they practice, and what were they trying to speak to me? And this was actually the way for me to figure out that my ancestry, part of it does come from China. Most of it comes from the native region of Manchuria, which in itself had people from North Siberian descent, had people from Mongol descent, and even had people from Korean and to some extent Turkic descent. And it was that process of exploring the travelings that people had, the migrations that people had, especially with the Silk Road being just right there, what kind of magical exchanges, spiritual and cultural exchanges happened, and thereby what exactly did people practice. And for me, it was especially difficult because the Manchurian regions had especially unfortunate events where a lot of the culture had long gone into decline. So because of these migrations, I started looking into the neighboring cultures on what each of them had done. So I looked more into North Siberia, into Mongol, into Korean, and to some extent to Turkic as well, and of course Chinese. And basically, piece by piece, I was able to place some of the spiritual practices back together, combined with what I had practiced growing up, and with a little bit of guidance and nudging from the spirits around me who started to emerge in a form where I could more easily identify them.
So you're saying that the first step for you was just finding out who you are, just understanding your own ancestry. Did that take place on Ancestry.com, or were you able to ask family, filling these gaps for me, or did you even travel? What did that consist of? Since that seemed like that was like the first task you were being given by spirit, what did that consist of to begin engaging in that way, to find out this information?
Honestly, all of the above. I did go to several DNA websites, and they were actually the ones that pinpointed where some of my bloodlines come from. I did ask family, not so much like who I was descended from, because they did not have as much idea, but I did ask them about the history of my parents' last names and where those had come from. And then I also frequently went back to East Asia and Northeast Asia specifically to pinpoint how did people move in the recent years and where those people have possibly moved from. So it was a number of different things. Like, for example, the last name that I use right now, Shi, that actually is written in Chinese as the character for history. That last name is very, very uncommon in terms of Chinese last names. So through looking at the history of that last name per se, I was able to find that it came from two sources. One, that I was descended from a particular family of royal historians in a certain dynasty. Or two, it came from people who descended from Turkic refugees who escaped and fled into China roughly 1,000 years ago when they were conquered by a neighboring Turkic empire. So that last name essentially spread into China, eventually became a Chinese last name, although a very much uncommon last name. And my mother's last name, her last name is actually Ji. Pretty much every source indicates that it is either of Southeast Siberian or Mongol source that, again, went through that process of becoming more Chinese-sounding. Because my family ended up on the Chinese side of the border after the borders were set for which countries delineating Russia and China. So, of course, everything became much more Chinese-sounding afterwards. So in the long run, it was basically all of the above. I understood very much that using one method will not give all the answers because all of them had deep holes. The first things I noticed was that each particular source had so many holes, and I had to pursue as many sources as possible so that any overlap can essentially cover any of those gaps, those voids.
And so what was the next step for you? Like, after you sort of accumulated some knowledge about your own background and who you are, what was yeah, what happened next? Sort of. I'm just so curious about this conversation. You know, to begin with this idea of family practices from a just in case place, and then the mantle sort of being given to you in a no, you're really going to do this, you know, like not just a just in case, but like you're really we're going to come into your dreams and shake you up. What was next for you after you began exploring this?
The next was essentially looking a little bit broader. What are some of the similarities that the practices I had growing up, how did they connect with these areas and these lands that I found where my ancestors have come from? And even now, a lot of it seems to have tied to the North Asian shamanic beliefs of the sky, which the Mongols refer to as Tengger, and their native spirituality is referred to as Tengerism. So actually for a lot of my everyday nowadays, I will tell people that I am a Tengerist because a lot of my beliefs and a lot of my practices draw very much and are very much similar to the Tengerist practices of this heaven and to this heaven-oriented belief along with the earth as well. And it's basically exploring these similar native traditions that are neighbors to Manchuria. And some there, it's basically tying pieces together and seeing what seems to be too much of a coincidence. And I've even looked as far as Scandinavia, believe it or not, because in East Mongolia, near Manchuria, there were a set of runes that were found. They were referred to as the Orkhon runes. And they actually were the writing system of the old Turkic empire that spanned across Eurasia, known as the Kok Turks, or the Blue Turks when translated. And I even pursued that all the way to the Norse practices to see if there was any possible link between the Norse runes and the runes and the Orkhon runes that were found in East Mongolia. Linguistically, there was extremely little similarity, but spiritually and magically, there could be a potential argument for similarity, but that was where the lead was, and that was where I left it at, which ended up me studying a lot of runes, of Norse runes. But it's basically situations like this example. What was a particular practice in North China that my ancestors from that region practiced? And throughout college, when I really started going into this traditional Korean drumming art of pungmulnori, that very much resonated with my spirit to the point where I was getting dreams from ancestors. And even when we were drumming, you could sometimes hear the voices of ancestors singing. And that was basically one of the hints that told me that I had some ancestry from Korea, which was then confirmed through DNA tests. And so exploring some of the spiritual practices there. So it's a lot of similar examples like these random bits of finding similarities between practices and basically exploring them, studying them, and if I could find any kind of confirmation that that was what my ancestors practiced, how applicable is it to me now? So, and it's through all of these many, many piece-by-piece discoveries that I started to formulate a picture for myself in terms of my own spiritual practices. But even today, as I mentioned earlier, my practices are very much focused on the concept of Tengger in heaven and then the earth mother here, which is basically the basis for our current middle world, and the Siberian world tree concept of connecting the middle world with the upper world and the lower world, which basically is a rough framework of my current practice.
So the way it seems like it, so what it sounds like is that you found a home for yourself, but there are practices that possibly were not practiced by your ancestors from sort of neighboring traditions that also have appealed to you or seemed like appropriate, would you say, to bring into your practice as well?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's finding appropriate pieces from neighboring cultures. It's more that I discovered links between my own ancestors and the ancestors of neighboring cultures, and basically trying to find the source of that link. And because the link to the Manchurian regions, a lot of it has been severed, it's following the links of the neighboring cultures to see where that practice has come from. So it's more of using the neighboring cultures' practices to sort of rediscover my own ancestral practices. And because of the people of North Asia used to travel extensively, it is very, very common for someone of North Asian descent to have the blood of their neighboring cultures as well. And that essentially was the key that I used to sort of discover what my ancestors were trying to tell me and what the spirits of those particular lands were trying to say to me. Because when all is said and done, these spirits approached me to pursue this kind of work. Given the sort of the outline that my family kind of originally wanted for me, which was not spiritual at all, I very easily could have not paid attention to any of this, but because they've been calling me so hard and my life at the moment felt like it was at a point of stagnation, that I wanted to explore the heritage that the ancestors that I didn't know of, what they have potentially left for me. That was what was driving all of these actions.
So essentially you've been engaged in a conversation that I think so many people can relate to, no matter how far they feel, you know, no matter how removed they feel from ancestral practices, even the word ancestral practices, that, you know, they're saying, you know, I don't have any at all, you know, it's impossible. You know, you've been engaged in the work of filling in the gaps. And I think that even for people who might not find their way to North Asian magical and shamanic practices, would be inspired by the path that you've been taken, because it's so similar to what so many people have to do. Some people find it, you know, more long and arduous, but some people, you know, have taken it up really creatively, like it seems that you have. We're going to take a quick break, and I can't wait to continue this conversation right after this this break with wonderful audio that you've provided us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, of course.
Oh.
Chat room are asking what the last track was that we just heard.
So, for those of you who've heard the recurring sound, Kanggang Sulle, this is a very, very old Korean folk dance that originated years and years before even Buddhism emerged in Korea, back when it was still engaged very much in its indigenous shamanistic practice. And this particular dance called Kanggang Sulle, because this name is very old, there's a lot of disagreement on what this name actually means. But the general consensus was that this is a dance that is generally performed in October under the Harvest Moon or the Autumn Moon Festival, and is very much associated with bringing down the harvest, of bringing this harvest in, making sure that we have enough food to last over the winter. In fact, the two general agreed meanings for Kanggang Sulle is one, may the tenth month descend on us, the tenth month being the harvest month, so the full power of the harvest. And the second meaning is may the waters continue to come down on us. Because October is sometimes known as the water month, not so much that there's a lot of rain, but more so because there is a lot of wealth flowing in that was very much associated with flowing water. So this was the dance. This is actually the dance that has survived thousands and thousands of years and is now even protected as part of the United Nations Cultural Preservation Act. So it's one of the oldest relics of Korea that predates most other aspects of Korean culture.
And while we're focused on Korean culture, I want to return to this conversation of Pungmulnori, the traditional Korean drumming practice. And the moment you said wealth, it reminded me of you telling me in passing some time ago that the drumming troupe that you work with, there's a particular, I don't know if it's a particular time of year or if it's an ongoing thing, but that the drumming troupe doesn't just sort of practice artistically. It's not just a form of cultural practice and preservation, but that there's a strong ritual element embedded in the Korean community that you that shops invite you in to perform. Could you speak a bit to that?
Sure. So this actually takes place on the Lunar New Year, which some people might know better as the Chinese New Year, although it's celebrated throughout Asia, so I will refer to it as the Lunar New Year. In the Korean Lunar New Year tradition, drumming troops would actually come drum around the community and would approach households and businesses, essentially inviting the owner of the business or the head of the family to come out and greet the drummers. And basically, the drumming, this this particular drumming is called Qixin Baoji, which translates to awakening the spirit of the earth. And or in some cases, it translates to stepping on the spirits of the earth, which is also applicable. It indicates that the Lunar New Year is a time when we welcome the return of spring, when spring is still not here yet, so it still very much feels like winter, but it's basically beckoning the spirits of the earth to awaken and for spring to come. And when we drum into the particular businesses and shops, we are essentially leading the awakening spirits into those shops to bring their bounty and to bring their harvest into the shop. So essentially, it is a way of bringing blessings of prosperity to the particular shops and the businesses throughout the year. And this is actually not just one group. This is actually a combination of several groups in New York City that come together to do this. I know Los Angeles also does this in California and in some other cities in the U.S. where there is a strong Korean population. But in New York, it is several, three or four groups, including the NYU group, actually, which I was originally part of. We come together, and this is a celebration for us, and it also, a lot of the businesses love it as well. So it is a cultural practice of awakening the spirits of the earth and bringing their blessings upon these businesses that we visit. And in exchange, what also happens is usually, customarily, the businesses give the drumming groups a little bit of money donations for the drummers themselves. And the drummers usually, in preparation, we actually create this almost talisman, but basically it is a small replica of the baskets that were used to collect rice, and they have a ribbon inscription on them, and this would be given to those business owners, and they would act as a sort of almost like a talisman to, or in a sense, almost like a mini altar to the earth spirits that we have brought in. So it's a lot of different things happening at once, but it is very much centered on the drumming aspect known as Pungmul Nori.
That's so beautiful. And as you're saying this, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show that I just spent this past week in a retreat that was sort of focused on shamanic practice, and a huge aspect of that was rituals, engaging in rituals directly related to the elements, to earth, air, fire, and water. So this ritual of music and sound awakening the element of earth and the spirits of the earth to bring in prosperity, and then having this sort of long-term aspect, this sort of talismanic object, that it's just incredible that cultures all over the world, the symbols being different, but the technologies being similar, music and sound to awaken spirits associated with particular element, to engage that element on behalf of us as human beings in a particular aspect of our lives. I'm really moved at almost to the point of tears right now.
If I may, one thing I do want to add, since you did bring up the elements, yes, it is awakening the earth spirit, but also a beautiful thing about this drumming tradition, it's known as Pungmul Nori. Pungmul is actually in reference to, it literally translates to the stuff of wind. Pungmul Nori actually, in its purest sense, represents a thunderstorm. This drumming tradition consists of four instruments, and each one is a different aspect of a thunderstorm. So it's very much sort of like calling the heavens through the storms to awaken the earth spirit. So it's a whole cycle that is built into this practice. And really, it's because this is very much tied to Korean culture, a lot of the old Korean spiritualities is very much centered on agricultural practices. So a lot of the spirituality and the magic and the rituals are very much tied to agriculture. So everything is tied to the movements of the sky, of the water, the rain that comes, the storms that come into the earth and then back. It's very much of a circular, cyclical process in this whole cosmology.
I'm in awe of the beauty of that. I'm curious, while we're talking about drumming, because one question I did have was if Pomonori was solely a group practice, which it sounds like it is, because you say that, you know, there's sort of four elements involved. But I'm curious as to how, if, and how the drum or drumming factors into other practices of yours.
Well, typically when I do drum, even for myself, drumming is like similar to, as I mentioned earlier, an awakening. And it's almost when I frequently drum in all of my personal practices, my personal rituals. Drumming, in its sense, as I'm sure most people already know, it puts you into a state of consciousness where you are open, and you are able to see and feel and hear so many that's beyond our physical realm, which is why you see shamanic drumming come up in cultures around the world, and that's something that I use as well. And I do use my Korean drum extensively, but I similarly have another hand drum, which I use for some of the aspects of Siberian spirituality, that part of my ancestry, which is also just simply a lot easier to carry because the Korean drum is huge and in practical terms is not very possible to dance around unless you have it tied up to yourself, which in itself is another whole process. But it's between the Korean drum that I use, the one that's shaped like an hourglass, and the hand drum that I use, they both very much are incorporated into my personal practices and in connecting with the spirits of my ancestors and the spirits of the land around me and some of the nature and the elemental spirits as well. It's in a way, it is also an offering. It's a manifestation of your energy that is transported through the medium of sound. So drumming is, for me, has always been very, very significant in my own work. And they say that when you are drumming, and they say this in Korean drumming, but I think they say this in other forms of drumming as well, is that sometimes as you drum, you approach that trance, you hear the wailing singing voices of your ancestors, which I think some people have, some of the less spiritual people have tried to say that those are harmonics. But at least in my own practices, that is a method that I use to commune to the spirits who are with me.
Because it sort of sounds like you yourself are saying that you actually have heard them engage and sing along. This isn't just a something that can be scientifically, you know, swept under the rug. Harmonics. You it seems like this was a direct tie to a deeper engagement with your ancestors.
Yes, very much so. It's it was actually through I started doing this Korean drumming of Pumonori in university, and it was actually through these experiences that I was having then that I became aware from these spirits and later through DNA tests that I did have some Korean heritage as well. So that is the reason why I started pursuing that aspect in my wider spiritual practices.
So one of the questions that come up in the chat room is about your name, David, and if David is your birth name.
So this is actually a somewhat interesting and somewhat boring story. So my English name, David, was given to me at the same time as my Chinese name. Given the environment where my grandparents and parents had grown up, Chinese had become the dominant speaking language in a land that is not traditionally China, but it is still... It's because they grew up and they were very familiar with speaking a Manchurian version of Mandarin, they then gave me a Chinese name and an English name, and actually at the same time, because I was born in the U.S. not long after my parents had come over to this country. And they wanted my, in the naming traditions of East Asia, there is sort of an implied process in which the name you give to a child is the name that you want them, is the aspect that you want them to be as they grow up. And my parents wanted me to be, like, strong, to be upright, to be just. So they actually, the Chinese name they gave me, they made sure that it sounded similar to a potential English name they gave me. So the English name they gave me was David. The Chinese name they gave me was Dai Wei, which sounds pretty similar. Dai is actually referring to mountains, to the aspects and qualities of mountains being strong and being in resistance, being in place, being not easily swept away. And then Wei indicates sort of like power or degree, and basically like strength. So it's basically the strength to the degree of a mountain that they gave me. And because my parents come from Manchuria, the pronunciation of this Chinese name in standard Chinese would be Dai Wei, but in the Manchurian accents, it would become Dai Wei. So like the V would come in, which is a sound that normally doesn't exist in Chinese, but it is used in that area when they are speaking Mandarin Chinese. So that's the general story of how my name came out to be.
There's nothing boring about that at all. that's really deeply fascinating. You know, especially for those of us who, you know, can't necessarily pinpoint anything too deep about our name. You know, about the way in which we were named. Are there any other names that you've accumulated or that have been given to you or that have been important in your practice? You know, some spiritual traditions, some people experience being given names by mentors or teachers or by spirits themselves. Has that ever happened, anything along those lines?
Not to the extent of a actual name given upon initiation in any traditions. I've sometimes, through certain settings, mainly spiritual journeys or when interacting with spirits, they would refer me to several different names which may carry the implied meaning of, for example, a warrior or a general, or in some cases of an animal that is in my energy field, a spirit animal within my energy field, such as a bear or eagle, but not so much names used in everyday life. These are just sort of like pseudonyms or titles that sometimes come about. And mountain actually does appear quite frequently because that was the intention given to me at birth. So it is obviously present in my overall energy field. And one thing to mention is that mountains, I'm not sure about in other traditions, but I know in especially the North Asian traditions, mountains held very, very significant importance. And even in Chinese traditions, actually, now that I think deep about it, mountains were generally had very, very powerful energies, had very powerful spirits, and in some cases demons residing in them. And oftentimes in North Asia, people would actually travel to a mountain to make prayers or to do meditations because of the whole significance of mountains. So that has been one. But in reference to your question, there hasn't been so much of a new name being given or being used, but in my personal experience, there have been titles that I've been referred to in place of my name. But it's the concept of a alternative name is actually not a big one across East and North Asia. The one exception that I would give to this is if you take vows to enter Buddhist monasteries, then they would give you a Buddhist name. But other than that example, there is this is not a widely practiced of behavior in any case. I see it mostly in Buddhism, but not outside of that very much.
We'll be taking another quick break, sharing some of the wonderful music you provided us with for this episode. And when we come back, I'm excited about spending the third part of our show looking more deeply. I know that the second part of the show, we sort of got engaged in this beautiful practice of Pomo Nori, which I think just provides an excellent window for people into not just practices, but their connections to land spirits, and those connections to land spirits and how they affect daily life. And I can't wait to come back and talk more about your own personal practice, you know, the sort of day-to-day. And again, you're someone who, as I've had other people on the show, who lives in New York City, and I get to see. But I also know that being a New York City spirit worker provides a particular lens to our work. So, again, thanks so much for being here, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
happy, happy, really happy.
Thank you.
All right, I'll carry on one next time.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances, contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Wednesdays from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual. We're back. My name is Kai Armand, and I am the host, and I am here with guest David Shi, who is an animist and folk magician of Manchurian descent, and we've been discussing North Asian magical and shamanistic practices and traditions. David, before we continue, the last audio track we just heard, what was that?
So that was actually, as you can probably tell from the applause at the end, that was a performance at the BBC Proms concert. That was a Mongolian throat singing ballad. That particular piece, it's not an old traditional piece, it's actually a pretty new piece. It basically sings about the history and the glory of the Mongol population, and what is kind of stressed in the piece, which I'm talking is when I say Mongol population, that doesn't just simply indicate Mongolia. That indicates all the Mongol people located throughout Mongolia, Russia, China, primarily these areas. So it's very much a voice talking about the whole section of the Siberian population, of which I have just a tiny bit of blood coming from. Not a lot, but just a little bit. But it is also a direct neighbor of the Manchurian people that I do descend from, and therefore we actually do share a lot of spiritual practices, which I've discovered. And actually, the Mongolian spirituality source is one that I've been using a lot, given the exchanges that have happened between the Mongolian and the Manchurian people, both culturally and spiritually. So it is actually a culture that I've studied very deeply. When I look at old Manchurian texts, a lot of it plays with Mongol spirituality. So that actually does have a significant impact in my own practices. Even to the extent where when I talk to people from other Asian cultures, when I tell them that I'm Manchurian, they automatically think Mongolian. So it's a little funny that way.
Interesting. And coming back to this idea of your own practices, we talked a bit about, the role that Pumunori plays in your life and how it's also played in your spirituality, but on a more solitary way, what would you say some of your practices consist of? Do you do divination? I know that you mentioned that, or at least I mentioned in your description earlier, that you are a folk magic practitioner, and that you're also, as a folk magician, you do bring in some aspects of other traditions into your folk magic practice as well. So tell us a bit about what things look like for David one-on-one.
Sure. So in my daily traditions, I do a lot of just quick cleansings and quick blessings, because the aspect of North Asian traditions is that there wasn't a lot of time to focus on long rituals, so there's a lot of short rituals and short to the point practices. Like, for example, in Siberia, and this is a practice that I do myself, is every day as much as possible, just light a small piece of sage and circle it around the body 3 times. That's the quick cleansing. But otherwise, I also use a lot of my spirits through a lot of the tools that I use. For example, I talk to a lot of people how horse is extremely important in my daily practice. I use black horse hair when I'm conducting cleansings, and when I'm doing blessings, I use white horse hair. I do divinations of some extent. I, like everyone else, read tarot, of course. Through the earlier example I mentioned of analyzing any connections between the different families of runes, I have become very much versed in reading rune stones, so that's something that I do as well. And I do also incorporate bone reading. I do 2 types of bone reading. One type of bone reading is the multiple animal bone reading. It is extremely, extremely similar to the bone readings I see done in here in the U.S. among a lot of root work communities. In fact, it is, I will not say it's identical, but it is so similar that it's completely, like, mutually understandable. And then I also, on a much simpler way, do something called shagai, the shagai bones. Those are they're in some ways a way of saying yes or no, but they provide a little bit more detail in the situation, especially in the context of North Asian spirituality. Some people just want answers like yes and no and maybe a why, but they don't want the whole long, drawn-out explanation, so which is why shagai has become a very important relic in the North Asian spirituality, especially in Mongolia, where you roll the shagai, hear what the spirits have to say really quickly, and use that in your day-to-day. A lot of the practices that I incorporate are very spirit-oriented through the tools that I acquire, which most of the tools I acquire become spirit houses, and the fact that I invite my spirits and spirits who are with me to take up residence into those objects, and I'll use those objects in my own work. Sometimes they say no, but, I won't push them, but a lot of the times they say yes because they say, why not? So that has become a very crucial part in the tools that I use in my own space on my own altar. I do a lot of my practices is very much based on offerings and libations. The way that I do libations is traditional to the North Asian style, where you would actually, for liquids, you would give the libations or the offerings in units of three. The first is for the sky, the heavens, the spirit there, or in Siberian terms, the tengir that is there, the tengir. And then the second is for the earth. The earth, this is mainly the primary spirit of the earth, but it can include the other earth spirits and the spirits of the land that are there. And then the third unit of offering is given to the ancestors, to the ancestral spirits that are there. So a lot of my work is also giving these offerings to not only to appease spirits, but sort of gain spirits' favors in doing a lot of this work. And increasingly, the spirits have been telling me to incorporate more of the folk magic practices from around the world with regards to healing and with regards to just not necessarily lead people spiritually, but just in terms of improving people's spiritual lives and improving people's lives, which I think was an aspect or a factor in me coming across root work and hoodoo, which I actually started studying under you a couple years ago, I think. And especially through that cosmology, which has allowed me to learn so much, it has become a part of my daily practices as well. And I'm not sure if you asked me this already, but the majority of the work that I have done was for myself. I've had people come to me asking me for my services because they have one way or another found out about me. So I can take on clients and I can do work for other people, but so far the vast majority of what I've done is for myself, just these everyday small things of how I leave offerings, how I cleanse myself, how I bless myself, what I do to make sure that I have enough money or food to eat. And a lot, you'll notice the general theme among these North Asian indigenous practices, a lot of it is very much based on survival. In North Asia, where the climate is a lot harsher, the people, for example, in Korea, where it's a little bit more mild, and in Manchuria, a little less mild, they engage to some degree in agriculture. Korea is almost all agriculture. In Manchuria, it's partially agriculture, but partially nomadic hunting as well. And pretty much the rest of North Asia very much deals in nomadic hunting and raising livestock, not so much in agriculture. Are very much centered around this concept, this idea of surviving. And I think, especially with now, given our day and age, and with me studying folk magic and traditions beyond what I was raised in, it's become a bit more diverse, in which, especially in our day and age, we don't have to just survive anymore. We can do a lot more for our own spiritual, mental, physical progression. So it's everything is sort of a constant work in progress.
Well, it's so interesting that you say this, though, because, you know, root work and hoodoo, you know, so much of folk magic. You know, it was brutal to be a human being not too long ago, you know, and it still is brutal to be a human, you know, to be a human being and live a human life. Many places in the world, you know, hence the creation of that, you know, oft-used phrase, first world problems. But to see the engagement and the translation of these practices into the first world and into the Western world, you know, the Pungmul Nori taking place on a New York City street, you know, and walk, you know, and performing in a New York City, you know, edifice with four walls and a roof, you know. But you know, also, you know, root work and hoodoo also coming out of the need to survive and the need to outwit those elements that might be adverse to survival. So you know, get another piece that's mirroring. Question, do you teach people in the use of Chagai bones? Because I know that the Lucky Mojo, our sponsor, Lucky Mojo, sells Chagai sets. And I know that I think I've heard it called complicated fortune telling, even though it's a binary system, because it provides yes, no answers, but as you said before, it goes in a bit deeper. It's more than just yes, no. There's an element, there's a sheen to that. There's more to it than just yes, no. Do you teach people how to work with those at all, in case anyone, because I just know that that's one thing that we've spoken about that has definitely gotten some traction in the folk magic world, the use of Chagai bones.
It's something that I can teach, although to be very honest, the best way to learn Chagai bones is actually through practice yourself, although there certainly can be assistance in terms of interpreting how certain bones, the meaning of how certain bones land, because I know there's, across various sources, there's been charts made for what different bone combinations mean. But I think the lack is really coming from how those apply to our everyday situations or to particular questions, and to interpret how those positions of the bones, what they indicate. And something that people may or may not know is that each position of the Chagai bone landing corresponds to one of four different animals, and it's also there's also an involvement of how those animals interplay with each other. But in addition, there's also some various other factors as well. Chagai bones in general are known, the personality of those bones tends to be a lot more curt tends to give you just like short, sweet answers and like a general reason why that situation is to be. So, to answer your early question, Chagai bones is something that I certainly can teach in sort of like one or two classes at the very most, but a lot of it is really coming from just practicing with it and interpreting with it on your own and seeing how those bones interact with what the question is. Because as you mentioned, it is somewhat of a binary system. And because it is that binary system, there is the argument that people can simply memorize what the general meanings are. But there is also an aspect of spirit-led intuition that allows you to interpret exactly what those mean. Like, what does it mean when one animal shows up or a couple animals shows up, or if they are all different animals, how does that apply? So if anything, I would say that this bone system is, to learn in a very technical sense is a lot simpler than most other divination systems, but it does force you to come up with creative solutions fast.
Well, and I'm so glad that you mentioned, you know, the personality of the bones, because each form of divination, in my experience, really does have its own personality.
Definitely.
David, thank you so much for being a guest today. For those of you who are listening, again, David can be reached at I actually believe I made a mistake early at the beginning of the show. DavidJShi311@gmail.com. So that's DavidJShi311@gmail.com. Again, thank you for providing such a wonderful glimpse. Of course, it's just been a glimpse, just a bare overview of these rich practices that have been so influential in the West rediscovering shamanist traditions. And I look forward to seeing you really, really shortly.
Sure. Glad to be on.
This has been another episode of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience, in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine.